This is NBYC 2017. Our speaker is Brother Roger Lewis, and he has an overall topic of the secret of sound spiritual reasoning. This is class number 4, and it is entitled, How to Find the Blessing of a Strong Spiritual Partner. Brother Roger.
Well, let's start with the basics. Can I have a show of hands? Who's married? Ooh, okay, so here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4. So, okay, so good. So for those that are already married, it's too late. I can't help. For those that aren't married, you can either talk to the people in the front row, or you can also listen to these thoughts as well. So I'm going to come back to the particular question right at the end, how to find the blessing of a strong spiritual partner. And we're going to talk about that at the end, because I think there's a trick to that question. But before we do that, what we're really going to try and do is establish what's our biblical foundation. Well, how would we know what a strong spiritual partner is? So, yet again, the basis of sound spiritual reasoning is to go back to our Bibles and establish a biblical framework for what it is that we believe a strong spiritual partner may be, if we're looking for such a thing in our lives, in the wisdom of God. So where would we start? Well, obviously, we'd come back to the book of Genesis. So let's come back to the book of Genesis. And I want to draw your attention to a couple of things in Genesis 2 and Genesis 3 that, well, I think they are helpful with regard to the matter of what a strong spiritual partner might be, whether they be the man or the woman of that relationship. Now, before I just go into that, can I just mention this, that all of our lives are under the providential control of God. We believe that God controls all of our lives for his purpose and for our good. And perhaps it's important to say at this moment that not every single person will be married. It's not necessarily in the Father's purpose that all of us will find a marriage partner. But there will be others that will lead a single life and yet find absolute joy and satisfaction in the truth. And by the way, there will be some who will be married and will find difficulty and hardship within their marriage. What we do know is that the Father's hand is upon us all. But for those who will be married, the question of this particular study is obviously very relevant. How might we find such a spiritual partner? And again, the point is, how we go about it would be probably vastly different to what the world would do. I think in the world, by the way, it's largely a hit and miss affair. You hope you go to enough parties to bang into someone who may be roughly compatible. That's about it, really, isn't it? You find someone by some fairly vague mechanism. It's much more decisive with the truth because God's outlined the whole journey and the whole process. Now, just notice something about the formation of male and female. In Genesis chapter 2, do you remember what it says in verse 7 about the formation of the man? It says this. It says, "And Yahweh Elohim formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." Now, there's something more to that verse than meets the eye. And the interesting thing about this is that when it says that in Genesis chapter 2, you see that word formed, when it says he formed man, the Hebrew word is yotzar, and it means to mould as a potter moulds. So it's used that way in Psalm 2, Jeremiah 19, Zechariah 11, amongst a whole bunch of other Bible references. It's got overtones of a potter making or moulding a vessel with his hands. And that's the particular word that's used to describe the formation of the man. And I think what we're being told here in Genesis is that man was formed by the divine potter as an organic creation in himself. He tends towards that which will personally achieve, and by the law of independence, he was molded as a creature of individuality. Adam was an entire separate entity of God's own making, molded as a single person right from the beginning. Now, why that's interesting is that's not quite how the woman was formed, was it? Because when we come to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 22, we're told that when Adam had a rib taken out of his flesh, verse 21, it says, verse 22, and the rib which Yahweh Elohim had taken from man made he a woman. But that passage in verse 22 about the formation of the woman isn't the same word in the Hebrew. This time, the word for making the woman is to build, like a builder builds a building. It's used in Genesis chapter 8, in the 1st of Kings 6, Malachi chapter 1, about building a city, or building a town, or building a temple, or building a wall. It's not the same word for the formation of the man. The woman was built in a different way. And of course, what's interesting is that she was built by the divine builder as a unique extension of another person, which isn't how Adam was formed. Adam was formed as a separate entity. Eve was formed as an extension of another. And so she tends towards that which will mutually reciprocate. So woman, by the law of sympathy, was fashioned as a person of companionship. So even in the formation of the man and the woman, we're led to the understanding from God's perspective that the role of a man and the role of a woman are not quite the same. Which makes sense, by the way, because otherwise why do we have male and female unless they intentionally are designed differently and to perform different roles? And those roles or responsibilities are given to us, we believe, in the next chapter. Because look at now their respective... Remember in the matter of the transgression in Genesis chapter 3, have a look at the judgment that comes upon the man and the woman in Genesis chapter 3. Now, this is what it says in verse 16 about the woman. Genesis 3, verse 16 says, "Unto the woman he said, I'll greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." So what it says concerning the female is different to the man. Because in verse 17 concerning the man, it says, "Unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife and eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread till thou return to the ground." Now, let's just see what it says then about the responsibility of the man. You see, notice there's a key word in verse 17. Adam was to know sorrow, in sorrow. There was to be a measure of sorrow brought upon Adam's life. But if we were to ask in what dimension, in what sphere, in what role would Adam's sorrow be felt, I suggest that what we're being told here in Genesis is this. That firstly, man was to exercise leadership and know the burden of responsibility. We know that because he was to rule over his wife. So he was to exercise leadership. But with that comes the burden of responsibility. It's part of the sorrow that a man has. In the case you don't think it's a sorrow, I can assure you that it is. The burden of responsibility is a sorrow to be borne. And secondly, man is to make provision. He was to provide the bread that the household ate. In fact, the idea of a breadwinner probably comes from Genesis chapter 3. Man's the breadwinner for the family. Well, that was the model of Genesis 3. But you see, to make provision is to know the weariness of effort. So man's sorrow would be discovered in the burden of responsibility and the weariness of effort. And one last thing about men, which is true, is do you know that men measure their self-worth by their achievements? When a man is made redundant from a job, they take it really bad. Because what you've done is unmanned them. Because suddenly, well, who am I? Because they had an identity through the job because it was my achievements, and now you've taken my job away, and so I don't even know who I am as a man anymore. Because men measure their worth by what they're achieving. I think that's all implicit in the Genesis record, you see, when we read it deeply. Now, that's not the sorrow that the woman was to experience. If the man was to experience the burden of responsibility and the weariness of effort, what about the sorrow of the woman? Verse 16 says, "In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children." So the woman also was to have sorrow But I think that sorrow was to be seen and felt in a different dimension to the man. Now, here's the sorrow of the woman. She is to give support and thus to know the pain of empathy. But she's been endowed with the skill of intuition to fulfill this. Women are more empathetic creatures. They just are. And she's also to provide nurture. But with that will come the anxiety of care. But she's been endowed with the gift of emotion to accomplish this. So let me just go back a step. I know you're about writing that down, but let me just go back a step so you can see those two. So the fullness of it, man is to exercise leadership, to know the burden of responsibility, but he's been endowed with the power of logic. Men have a certain logic to their reasoning. And it's a gift of God to accomplish that particular matter. Man is to make provision, know the weariness of effort, but he's been given the blessing of strength. He's a physically stronger vessel than a woman is. But when we come to the woman, she is to give support and to know the pain of empathy, but she has a skill of intuition that a man doesn't have. A married couple will go to the meeting, and on the way home, my wife will say to me, "Did you see Sister So-and-so?" "Yes." "I think she's got a problem." "Oh, I didn't know she had a problem." "She's got a problem." "How do you know?" "I just know." Women sense things that men don't even notice. They have a skill of intuition. It's part of a divine endowment given to them. But with that same skill comes the pain of empathy. They feel things that sometimes men don't. It's part of the blessing of God. Because I think this is what it means when it says, "In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children." Do you think every woman brings forth children? No. But they all have this sorrow, that maternal instinct, that sense of empathy. It's planted deep inside every single woman. It doesn't require the bearing of children to have that endowment. It's already there. It's part of how the woman's been formed. And secondly, she's to provide nurture and to know the anxiety of care. But she's been given the gift of emotion to accomplish this. She's able to reach out in ways that are consistent with the responsibility that God has given to her. And if a man measures his self-worth by his achievements, a woman measures her self-worth by her relationships. They're different. Men and women are different. There's something rather wonderful about that, isn't there? That God in his wisdom's designed all that so that when you bring those two together, now we begin to understand the Bible topic of marriage. The crucial differences in their formation and their areas of responsibility now become the basis for our investigation into the Bible topic of marriage itself. So let's come back to Genesis chapter 2 and just see that story again. Back in verse 21, when Adam first, where the record talks about what was going to happen here. So it says in Genesis 2 verse 21, Yahweh Elohim caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam and he slept. He took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh thereof. And of course we know, and it's a rather delightful thought, isn't it, that the deep sleep of Adam is symbolic of the death of Christ. And you see that word rib. The word rib, of course, in the Hebrew, do you know what the literal meaning of the word rib is? You don't know what the word rib really means in the Hebrew? Anyone know? It actually means side. Out of the side of Adam came forth his bride. And that reminds us, which we won't turn up, but that passage, very good cross-reference, in John chapter 19, you might remember, verses 33 and 34, we're told, "And when they saw that Jesus was dead already in a deep sleep, one of the soldiers with a spear pierced his side. And forthwith there came out blood and water. And out of the side of Christ and his sacrifice came forth ultimately the bride of Christ, formed out of his sacrificial death, just as Eve was to be formed by the deep sleep of Adam on this occasion." And so Eve was formed out of the sacrifice of Adam. And verse 22 says, "The rib which Yahweh Elohim had taken from the man made he a woman and brought her unto the man." I think what happens, two things happen when Adam woke out of his deep sleep. I think he said two things. The first thing he said was, ah, because he felt the pain. And the second thing he said was, ah, because he saw his bride. It was like this most amazing moment in his life when he saw this new made woman, and I think he absolutely fell in love with Eve. Do you know what it says, verse 23? I think we can tell that because the record says so. Adam looked at her and he said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. And I think when Adam looked upon Eve, he saw the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen. He fell in love with her. In fact, the Revised Standard Version says that this is how the Hebrew should be read. Adam said, this at last is bone of my bones. He felt absolutely united to this woman. Fell deeply in love with her. And I think God planned it. God planned it. In fact, do you know what Brother Thomas says in Elpis Israel? In terms of describing Eve, he says she was the last and fairest of his handiworks. She probably was the most beautiful woman that the planet's ever seen. She was the first perfect woman. And she's brought to the man. And Adam felt that at last he'd found a true partner with the necessary sympathies. He felt such a strong bond that he wanted nothing more other than to be married. See what it says, verse 24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Now, it's interesting because what it's really saying is that the reason why marriage happens, see that therefore, what it's really saying is that the reason why marriage works is because woman was taken out of man. And on the basis of the law of sympathy, she becomes his counterpart, his companion, and his helpmeet. And God, by his creative act, designed the man and the woman that they might reflect the divine likeness within the bond of marriage. See, verse 24 is odd, really, when you think about it. Shall a man leave his father and mother? Don't you think a woman leaves her father and mother as well? Why is it just the man that leaves his mum and dad? But you see, what it's saying is that this man is so moved by the relationship of love that he now has with this woman that he begins the headship of a new, unique family unit. Only the man does that. That family unit will be in his name. He leaves to begin a new family unit with this woman. So moved is he by his love for her and his desire to have that relationship with her. For this cause, therefore, shall a man leave his father and his mother and form such a unit by cleaving unto his wife. Now, this is what Brother Thomas said in Elpis Israel about that. He said this. He said, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Thus Adam pronounced upon himself the sentence that was to bind them together for weal or woe until death should dissolve the union. This was marriage, says Brother Thomas. It was based upon the great fact of her formation out of man, and consisted in Adam taking her to himself with her unconstrained consent. There was no religious ceremonial to sanctify the institution, for the Lord himself even abstained from pronouncing the union. No human ceremony can make marriage more holy than it is in the nature of things. So you see, what Brother Thomas is saying, it's quite a thoughtful comment really, isn't it? Is that his, Adam's, was to take this woman unto himself. Hers was to consent to the taking. And implicit in that idea of her consent to the taking is the idea of submission on her part. But implicit in Adam's work was that he had first had to sacrifice before this bride could be presented for him and to him. So the man would learn sacrifice and the woman would learn submission. And both those principles are hidden in the record here in Genesis chapter 2, verses 23 and 24. And the Bible says God designed that so well that no marriage ceremony can make it any more holy than it is in the way God's designed it, that these two people are brought together in this particular way. So what we've really got here, you see, is the beginning of what we might describe is a principle of sacrifice and submission. And I think these are the twin principles that guide a marriage successfully. For the man, he must learn sacrifice. For the woman, she must learn submission. And what's interesting is that they're actually two sides of the same coin. Because when you think about it, what is sacrifice but submission to the other's need? And what is submission but the sacrifice of one's own will? And so what God calls upon us to undertake in the bonds of marriage is those two principles, that a man must learn to sacrifice for his wife, and a woman must learn to submit to her husband. And why those ideas are so special is not only because they're very different to what the world teaches, but because this is the key to how marriage works. Because it's implicit in this bit here, is when marriage is nurtured by the sacrifice of love and the submission of reverence, then marriage is about meeting obligations and not claiming rights. And marriage is about fulfilling needs and not demanding privileges. It's all about what you do and can do for the other person in that marriage. It's about how you might meet their obligations. Now, that's the very reverse of what the world says. The world says, if your marriage goes wrong, you've got rights, you should demand what you want. If it doesn't work, you walk out and start again. And the idea of sacrifice and submission is completely foreign to the marriage relationships of the world. In fact, they would be just words that are not in their vocabulary. But the Bible says that's the key to success. You want a marriage that not only will survive, but a marriage that will thrive, then build it on the twin foundations of sacrifice and submission. Do that and you'll find happiness. And it's absolutely true. But where do those principles begin? Right in Genesis chapter 2. So right from the beginning, not only do we have the principle of marriage, but I think we've got those twin ideas of what will guide and nourish that relationship. On the man's part, learn to sacrifice for her. By the way, it's the hardest thing for a man to do. A man will sacrifice for everything other than his wife. And for a woman, learn to submit to your husband. That's a hard thing to do. But in the doing of the hard things, and in focusing on meeting the needs of the other person, we have a recipe for happiness in married life that the world actually knows nothing about. Now, why that's interesting is because when we come to the gospel record, to the book of Matthew, do you remember what it says in Matthew's record, Matthew chapter 19? Because now we come to the teaching of the New Testament. And yet, when we come to the words of Christ, we will find that his view on marriage is totally based on the principles of Genesis chapter 2. So reading thoughtfully and carefully in Matthew, the record says this, Matthew chapter 19, and reading perhaps from verse 1. It came to pass that when Jesus had finished these sayings, he departed from Galilee and came into the coasts of Judea beyond Jordan. And great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. And the Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him, and saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? Now, I want you to notice two things about what the Pharisees talked about. They wanted to know about whether it was okay to put away a wife and the number of causes that made it possible to put such a wife away. Is it possible for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And you might know that in those days, there was a debate between two rival Pharisaic schools, the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel. And one of them was stricter than the other. One of them said, you can only put away a wife in the event of adultery. And the other one said, you can put away a wife for everything, if you really anything you like. If she hasn't cooked a good meal, that could be grounds for divorce. So one of them was a very liberal view, and one of them was seen to be a very strict view. But what they all agreed on is that there's at least one reason for putting away his wife. And so the question the Pharisees came is, Is it possible to put away a wife for every cause? In other words, is that particular Pharisaic view correct? Now, see what Christ says in answer. Verse 4. He answered and said unto them, have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? Now, that's what we saw, remember, in Genesis chapter 2. The formation of the man and the formation of the woman were different. And God's creation had purpose and intention in bringing a man and a woman together in that relationship. And so what does Jesus do to start his argument? He didn't say, well, I think about marriage this. He didn't say, well, I personally feel that what should be happening. No, he said, let's go back and find a scriptural basis for our reasoning. Answer, Genesis chapter 2. And the first thing he says is, think about the formation of the male and the female. That's what God did. Why did he do that? Because he had a purpose, an intention. And the intention was, verse 5, he said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. So now, for this cause is, I think, an allusion to that statement in verse 3. Can a man put away his wife for every cause? Jesus says, actually, the way I read my Bible is God brought them together for one cause. I don't read that God put them away for every cause. My Bible tells me about how God brought them together based on one cause, which was the way they were formed from the beginning as male and female. God designed that so that they would work together in a marriage relationship. What are you doing talking about putting them asunder? That's not how I read Genesis, says Jesus. And so that phrase for this cause in Matthew, isn't that the equivalent of the word therefore shall a man leave his father and mother in Genesis? For this cause. And then Matthew 19 verse 6 says, wherefore they are no more twain but one flesh. What God therefore hath joined together, let not man put asunder. Now, what do you think Christ meant when it says what God has joined together? Because didn't Brother Thomas say in Elpis Israel is that God didn't pronounce the marriage union? God did not do that. Brother Thomas says that God didn't pronounce the union in Genesis. So what does Jesus mean when he says God's joined them together? Any thoughts on that? How did God join them together if he didn't actually perform the marriage ceremony? In what way did God join them together in Genesis? Any thoughts? I think the answer is because he created the mental and physical makeup of men and women in the way he did so that when they came together, they would go. It all locks together and works. The role of the man, the role of the woman, the gifts of the woman, the gifts of the man lock together, and somehow it all clicks together because that's how God created them. He designed them to be joined together. That's what it means. The way he formed them. He established their different temperaments and their qualities. He organized their social feelings. He provided their spiritual goals to strive for. In all of that, he joined them together, says Jesus. God planned that in the very way in which he formed them. So this idea of one man, one woman, together for life as one flesh, was God's design for marriage to become the vehicle through which God might be manifested. And for that reason, Jesus says, verse 6, if that's the case and that's the purpose, then let not man put asunder. Why are you talking about any basis for a marriage to be put asunder when the entire purpose of God was to bring them together so that they might better manifest him? So here's the question. So this is Matthew chapter 19. And what's the basis of Christ's teaching on the marriage state? Genesis chapter 2. He quotes Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. So the divine standard of marriage that began in Eden is still what Jesus is quoting in Matthew chapter 19. And so the record of Adam and Eve, which obviously, by the way, Christ accepted as genuine, set the basis and the benchmark for marriage according to God's pattern. Now, when we come to the book of Ephesians, chapter 5, you'll know that that's Paul's writing about marriage. But I want to show you a couple of interesting thoughts in Ephesians, chapter 5, about how Paul does write about marriage and the basis of his spiritual reasoning. So Ephesians chapter 5, and reading from verse 22, notice what it says first about wives. Let's read verses 22 to 24. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the ecclesia. He's the saviour of the body, and therefore as the ecclesia is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Now I want you to notice a couple of interesting things about what Paul says here about wives. Firstly, do you notice how Paul's principles are centred on the perspective of the truth? So read carefully, verse 22. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. See that crucial bit? Do it as if it was unto the Lord. Your marriage has an overtone of the truth about it. Verse 24. Therefore, as the ecclesia is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands. As it is in the Lord, verse 22. As it is in Christ, verse 24. So there's an overtone here that governs the relationship of a wife to her husband based on the reality of the truth itself and the matter of Christ and his relationship with his own bride. And if that's the case for the husband, for the wives, then notice what he says about husbands from verses 25 to 29. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the ecclesia, gave himself for it that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious ecclesia, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the ecclesia. So notice, verse 25, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ loved the ecclesia. Verses 27 and 28, that just as Christ might present the ecclesia to himself, verse 27, so ought men to love their own wives, verse 28. So when he talks about the wife in verse 22 and 24, it's as it was with Christ and his bride. And when he talks to the husbands in verse 25 and verse 27 and verse 28, it's as it is between Christ and his bride. So what he's saying, of course, is that within our marriages, well, he's going to go on and say this, isn't he? Verse 32. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the ecclesia. So what Paul says as he reasons about marriage is he says, you know, in our marriages, in the truth, when a man loves his wife and a woman reverences her husband, what they're doing is they're enacting the mystery of Christ and his bride. They're enacting the mystery of Christ and his bride. And you know what? The world doesn't know anything about that type of marriage. The world doesn't know anything about that type of relationship where the mystery of Christ and his bride is being outworked in what we do and say with our marriage partners every day. The world has no understanding of that. And what are the principles that lie at the heart of this special marriage, this fulfilling marriage? Husbands, verse 25, I want you to notice the key words. Love your wives. Give yourself for them, verse 28. Love your wives, verse 29. Nourish them and cherish them. Do you know what all those words add up to in one word? Sacrifice. Sacrifice for your wife. Now, what about the wife? What should wives do? Verse 22, submit to your husband. Verse 24, be subject to your husband. Verse 33, reverence your husband. In a single word, submission. So the two guiding principles that Paul comes back to in terms of what should be at the heart and soul of a good marriage Husbands, learn the principle of sacrifice. Wives, learn the principle of submission. Now, where did the Apostle Paul get all those ideas from? And what's the basis of his biblical reason? Well, he says this, verse 29. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the Ecclesia. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. And the Apostle Paul quotes, why, surprise, surprise, Genesis chapter 2, verse 23 and 24. So the basis of the Apostle's reasoning on the marriage state comes from the story of Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 2, which is exactly where Christ based his teaching on marriage from. Now you see how consistent that is. Genesis 2, Matthew 19, Ephesians 5, all based on the foundation principles that began in the Garden of Eden. All reason from the same way out of Scripture. Well, that takes us to the last book of the Bible and to the book of Revelation. Because you might remember that in Revelation chapter 19, there is something about marriage right at the end of the Bible, and I think that there is a relationship here to Genesis chapter 2. So in Revelation chapter 19, in verses 7 to 9, it says this: Let us be glad and rejoice and give honour to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife hath made herself ready. And to her was granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, clean and white, for the fine linen is the righteousness of saints. And he saith unto me, Write, blessed are they which are called unto the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he saith unto me, These are the true sayings of God. And so I believe that when we come to this passage in Revelation chapter 19, and it's about reading it carefully, that what we really have is Genesis chapter 2 coming full circle. And that in the marriage of Revelation 19, we do have an allusion to the circumstances of Genesis chapter 2. Now, here's why. Because when the man of the age to come, that's Christ, sees his wife made ready for him, verse 7, I believe that Christ will be moved with the same feelings that energized Adam. All Adam wanted to do was take his wife to himself. And that's how Christ will feel about his bride. All Eve felt was that she wanted to be with her husband. And that is exactly how we will feel about Christ. And that spirit in Genesis, when Adam first looked up and saw Eve and said, This is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, is exactly how Christ will feel towards us. And exactly how we will feel towards him. There's something very mystical about this, isn't there, in terms of looking forward to what the kingdom will be like and being joined to Christ. It's not the same as a normal marriage. It's a meeting of minds. It's a whole community that are gathered together in this way. But what it's saying is that what we experience in our marriages today is a taste of what it will be like to be joined as a community with Christ in the age to come. And when you think about it, what do you think Genesis chapter 2 was really all about? And the answer is, don't you think that the marriage of Genesis 2 was always intended from the beginning to point to the marriage of Revelation chapter 19? This is the real marriage. This is the last marriage. This is the ultimate marriage. This is the best marriage. The marriage of the Lamb is come. And his wife hath made herself ready. Or do you notice that? What was the rule in Genesis? How many wives would a man have? Just one, says God. When Adam was lonely and God said, I need to solve that, he didn't make Adam 10 wives. Could God have made 10 wives? Yep. But he didn't make 10. Didn't even make 2. He said, make one. One's enough. In fact, one's perfect. One's all you need. And there had to be one because there's only going to be one at the end. One to the last Adam. One to the first Adam. And you know, I think it's hidden in the text. Have a look at this. So there it is. The marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife hath made herself ready. But let me change the colour. His wife, Genesis chapter 2. His wife, Matthew 19. his wife, Ephesians, his wife, Revelation 19. One man, one woman, for life, begun in the garden and now taken forward into the kingdom age when Christ comes and looks upon his bride and says, I desire to be made one with this person that I have sacrificed for. And do you think that we will want to submit to Christ? Every time a bride submits to her husband knows what it will feel like for us to submit to Christ. Every time a man sacrifices for his wife, he will know how Christ felt to form his bride. This is stuff that the world doesn't understand, but it's something that we do. So Brother Thomas says this, just to finish that story, this is what he says in Elpis Israel, page 54. If you ever thought that Brother Thomas wasn't romantic, or that he wasn't emotional, you need to read him carefully, because I think he was. I think he was terribly emotional and extremely spiritual in his thinking. So this is what Brother Thomas says in Elpis Israel. He says, a community of such individuals constitute the mystical body of Christ, the beloved Eve of the last Adam, the Lord who is to come from heaven and make her of the same holy spiritual nature as his own. Thus, the ecclesia is figuratively taken out of the side of her Lord. Where did Brother Thomas get that from? Why, Genesis chapter 2? What thinkest thou? And then he says, the presentation of Eve to the first Adam was the signal of rejoicing to the morning stars. And we perceive that the manifestation of Messiah's queen will be attended with the alleluia of a great multitude saying, let us be glad and rejoice, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife hath made herself ready. Oh yes, Brother Thomas knew the emotion of marriage and the wonder of that time to come. And we're playing all of that out in the mystery of our own marriages. There's something very precious about knowing the truth, isn't there? Very privileged to know such principles, that we might live in a marriage bond with those objectives in mind. So the question was, at the start of this study, remember, so how do we go about finding a spiritual partner? And I think the answer is, why, in Genesis chapter 2, isn't it? Shall we go back and have a look and see what it said? Because I think the answer lay in Genesis all along, you see. So we're getting ready for our workshop moment. It's coming up, it's coming up, it's coming upon you very shortly. But notice this in Genesis chapter 2, verse 22. Verse 21. Yahweh Elohim caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept, and he, Yahweh Elohim, he took one of his ribs, and he, Yahweh Elohim, he closed up the flesh instead thereof, and the rib which Yahweh Elohim had taken from man, he, Yahweh Elohim, builded into a woman, and he, Yahweh Elohim, brought her unto the man. Ah, now that's what Genesis says. So finding the blessing of a strong spiritual partner is best accomplished by doing what Adam allowed God to do, and that was to find the bride of his delight and bring her to him. Isn't that what Genesis says? That's exactly what Genesis says. God organized the wife. God brought these two people together in the power of his providential wisdom. And I believe that's the best way to find a marriage partner, is to copy Adam. And so what Adam focused on was his scriptural and biblical responsibilities. And God said, and now, out of the blue, by the way, I've got someone for you. And he turned around and he was a woman. And Eve was the perfect person for Adam, but actually God found the woman, and God brought that woman to that man. And so you see, I believe that our part in the truth is not so much that if you're not married that you're not aware of potential partners. I'm totally aware that you'll be totally aware. But it's about what you then do as the next step. And I don't think the next step is to go and hunt one down. I think the next step is to pray to the Father about it, but to commit yourself to the work of the truth, to commit yourself diligently to the Father's work, and then leave it in His hands to bring you into contact with the partner of God's own choosing, because that's what Adam did. And by the way, when God does and He brings that person to you, I'll tell you now, you'll know. You'll know. But what you've got to be really clear on, is the spiritual qualities you're looking for in a suitable partner. So for the workshop moment, what I'm going to suggest we do is this, and this time I do need to actually break you up into two groups. So I'm going to ask for rows 1, 2, 3. No, not rows 1 to 3. I'm going to ask for all the ladies in the room to come across here, around the corner, into the sofa. And I want you to talk about one thing. Well, three things, actually. I want you to decide, based on what we've looked at this morning, and what you believe the three most important spiritual qualities are that you would be looking for in a spiritual husband. So if the ladies could all join, and then the men, if they could all congregate in the lounge, the sofa's at the end, and I want you to talk about the three most important spiritual qualities you would be looking for in a spiritual bride. And then what we're going to do is, after that little bit of discussion, we're going to bring them back, and we're going to see what you said. And then we're going to end up with a lesson from that. Okay, so you've got, shall we say, 7 minutes? That sounds like a very good spiritual epoch of time. Well, if you need that long. So the three most important qualities you're looking for, or believe you should look for, in a spiritual husband. And the three most important qualities, gentlemen, you should be looking for in a spiritual bride. Okay, one more minute, and you need to be able to report back with three things. Gentlemen, one more minute. And we need three things. All right, time to reconvene. So let's take our seats back, and we'll compare notes, shall we? Okay. Well, you know, it's like any Christadelphian occasion, you know, put people in the corner and give them a topic, and away they go. Just as well we didn't have, you know, cookies and coffee as well, because I wouldn't have ever got your stuff. So now there's a bit of a twist in the tale here. So let's start with the ladies first, because that's the right thing to do. So now, ladies, I say that, by the way, because I'm not sure that everyone's sisters, so it's a more inclusive term here. So what did you conclude, or did you come to a resolution on three critical things that you would be looking for in a suitable spiritual husband?
The first one was looking for a spiritual leader of the home.
A spiritual leader of the home?
Yeah, spiritually helping his wife and providing or making provision for time for spiritual food every day.
Is that all number one?
That was all number one.
Hey, that's pretty detailed. Okay, let's get some of that down. Spiritual leader for the home, yeah. And what else was it?
The second was being active in ecclesial service. So
yep.
Being
yep.
Part of the ecclesia.
Active in ecclesial service, yep.
And the third one was learning and knowing how to teach children to keep the truth alive to the kids following and grandkids, great grandkids, etc.
All right, so I'm going to put down, can handle the word to instill into the next generation. Is that close enough?
Oh, yeah.
So a spiritual leader to guide and nourish the home, active in ecclesial life, and can handle the word to instill in the next generation. Now you can see how that, if you were to put that towards the thinking of Christ, so would Christ be a spiritual leader that could lead his house? Yep. Is Christ active in the service of the truth? Yep. Can he handle the word to inspire a generation to come? Yes, people, when they heard Christ speaking about the word, their hearts burned within them at the way Christ was able to open up the scriptures and make them come alive. So I think those are three really interesting. Now, do you notice, incidentally, gentlemen, they didn't say about economic prosperity or tertiary qualifications or whether you already have a home or the quality of your car or even your stunning good looks. Which all goes to show that these are good choices because might these stand the test of time? Yep, because actually even good looks will fade, unfortunately. But these ideas won't. They're timeless. So they're excellent. So, now, gentlemen, on the other side, what do we end up with? Any conclusions?
It's funny for me, a bunch of leaders, we weren't really jumping to lead the discussion, but one of the ones we got, I think, was from 1 Peter 3.
Yep.
Verse 3 and 4, talking about, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, and putting on fine apparel, but rather let it be the hidden inward of the heart, the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God.
So give me the quality you were looking for out of that.
Inward beauty and gentleness of spirit.
Oh, that was very crisp, wasn't it? Now, let me give this out. Inward beauty and gentleness of spirit. It's interesting, isn't it? Because Peter talks about the hidden man of the heart, doesn't he? And incidentally, the hidden man of the heart is Christ. Is Christ hidden in her heart? Because if Christ's hidden in her heart, you'll see it. You'll know that Christ is there. And that's partly where her beauty lies. It's an inward beauty because Christ is the hidden man of her heart. And therefore, what she does as unto Christ, as well as to her husband, who she sees as Christ. So that's excellent. Now, another one from the men. We've only got one quality so far that you're looking at. Are you single-minded in your focus? This is the only one.
Virtuous.
Now, we mentioned this before. He's keen on the word virtuous. He likes the word virtuous. Well, her price is above rubies. But the trouble is, what does virtuous mean? Because actually, Proverbs 31 says she can spin with wool and she makes terrific knitting and she actually dyes purple garments and she goes and buys a vineyard and she trades. So which particular aspect of virtuosity did you have in mind?
I think we agreed on selfless.
Selfless. What do you mean by selfless?
Virtuous. She's, well, like Proverbs 31, she's like caring for the people who are around her, and like she's not afraid to be busy and active in that sense.
Okay.
You could say she has a love for the truth above her own desires.
Well, I'll put that down, love for truth above own desires. But what you're really saying there is, I'm just trying to grasp the complexity of your Proverbs 31 thinking here. If you were to distill it down to one quality, what would you say that is? Was it her willingness to work and be involved? Was it the fact she does that because she cares for others? She cares for her household. She cares for her maidens. She cares for her husband. Her husband shall praise in the gates. Her children shall arise and bless thee. Is it because of her care for others?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. What were you saying, John?
Just to care or serve others at the inconvenience of self.
Yeah.
Now, I wouldn't necessarily put that burden on her, even though it might be true. It could be at the inconvenience of herself, but the critical thing is probably the critical bit is probably the positive bit, which is the care and service of others. Whether it turned out to be inconvenient is it's not vital that it must inconvenience her, if I can put it that way.
It's possible, no different than service. You might not exactly get praise, you might actually get the Moses treatment for your service to others.
But the critical thing is the positive bit here, which is her care and service of others. She has that spirit of reaching out for care and service of others. Now, look, by the way, I like all of those. So let me just run through them. A spiritual leader who can guide the house, a man who's active in ecclesial service, and one who can handle the word to inspire the next generation. And on the other side, a woman of inward beauty and gentleness, someone who, I can't even read my own I can see what it is, a love for the truth above her own desires, and lastly, known for her care and service of others. That's quite good, really, isn't it? Now, here's the trick. The mistake you will make is in thinking, right, what were those things again? I'm looking for a girl of inward beauty. She loves the truth above, you know, her own desires, and she's caring for herself. I'm looking for a girl that guy can tick these three boxes. Gentlemen, you got it all wrong. The three boxes that you're looking for is that unless you are a spiritual leader that can guide the house, and unless you are active in ecclesial service, and unless you can handle the word to inspire the generation to come, she won't be interested in you. If you haven't got that to offer, there's no point you looking for a partner, because you're not offering what she needs. And likewise with the woman, there's no point you saying, I need to find a spiritual leader that can lead the house and handle the word and is active in ecclesial life now. Where is that brother who's passionate in the truth? No. Unless you have the inward beauty and gentleness of spirit that loves the truth above your own desires and is known for your care and service of others, he won't be looking for you or at you, because that's not what he needs or wants. So don't focus on what you're seeking in the other partner. You focus on whether you are able to offer what you must offer in order for that person to be drawn towards you. And having concentrated on your responsibilities and not the other person's, on your obligations and not theirs, on fulfilling their needs and not yours, then Yahweh in his providence can bring people together, because they've been actively busy in the truth service. Not because they're seeking a partner with a tick box, but because they're worrying about whether they have anything worthwhile to offer that might be of value for a spiritual partner. See how we can turn that completely around? Don't focus on the rights you're looking for in someone else. Focus on the contribution that you can make. So that's rather nice, actually. So if all the young ladies go away thinking... And by the way, it's not to say that you shouldn't dress nicely and take pride in your appearance, because that believe it, but the boys still think that's important, really. But actually what they really want long term is inward beauty, a love of the truth, and a care and service of others that shines out of her life. And what I said to the young men was, when you find that person, you will know. And in the case of a man, it will arouse an overmastering desire to protect and guard that woman for the rest of your life, because she is that person. And Yahweh does this in his providential wisdom. He brings us together. I wasn't looking for a partner specifically when Pauline came into my life. She certainly wasn't looking for a partner when she came to where I happen to live. But I know that for sure. But suddenly... circumstances happen. The really important thing is that you're focused on your responsibilities and the truth and what you can bring towards such a possibility. So I think at that point we'll bring this discussion to a close. Thank you for those very interesting and worthwhile contributions, and may God bless all of you in your journeys in terms of partners for life.